Welcome to Pivot Spokane on the Bookshelf. Tonight through Wednesday, we'll hear 8 personal stories on the subject of promises. This was from a presentation on November 2nd at the Washington Cracker Building. Tonight's 3 storytellers are Annika Eagle with her childhood list, Leonard Oakland's promise to Vietnam War resistors, and Megan Ferney on dating and climbing. Here's Pivot host Eric Woodard.
One of the things that they tell you is you get into teaching because you like the content, and you stay in teaching because you like the kids. That's been really true. I mean, you stay, especially as a high school teacher, you stay in it because the students, and this student is one that made it really fun to teach. So will you please welcome to the stage Annika Eagle.
So this summer, I got to spend my time seeing my sister, turquoise-clad, dance monkeys across a Seattle stage. And it was the final performance of the Strictly Seattle Dance Festival. And regardless of prior experience, you commit to 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, for 3 weeks to practice. And so on their final performance, the choreographer asked all of the dancers, you know, why did you decide? What was your inspiration for signing up for this hugely out of your comfort level experience? And my sister's response was me, that I was her inspiration. And it was this list that I had made when I was 10 years old, which was, I had promised myself that I was going to reach my full potential and overcome my shyness and find my voice and a list of ways to do it at 10 years old. So, some background. Both my parents are introverts, living in an extrovert's world. And as teachers, they expend most of their social batteries just in their normal workday. So my sister's extroversion was an unexpected disruption. They didn't know how to handle it. And I can remember watching them react to one of my sister's tantrums. And she's not here, by the way, my sister, so this is fine. And I remember deciding then and there that I was going to behave differently. And, you know, I would always shape myself around other people rather than taking up space myself. And so I still wonder whether the shyness that's plagued me off and on through the years has been more nature or more nurture. So at age 5, this might be easier, at age 5, we went to Helena, Montana for Christmas at my grandparents' house. And for some reason, all of the adults were gone except for my father, left in charge with all these children, my cousins and my sister and I. And we had a fun evening planned. We were gonna paint those chintzy ornaments that's like a ski chalet or the cabin, and it comes with the row of paints and the plastic. But the paintbrushes couldn't be found. So 5-year-old me has 2 long, thick braids down my back. Cue my father's aha moment. Annika, you have so much hair, you won't miss a few chunks. So he goes into the kitchen, and he pulls out a box of toothpicks. And then he goes to my grandfather's office, and he finds the scotch tape and the scissors. And, you know, I'm crying, I'm protesting, but he doesn't really realize that I'm not on board. And so he starts cutting chunk after chunk, enough for my 3 cousins, my sister and I, to each have 2 paintbrushes. Because you can't mix the light paint and the dark paint. That would be too painstakingly challenging. So, you know, was I not enough of an advocate for myself, or had I not yet found my voice? So, cue me coming into 2nd grade. We moved from Cheney to Spokane, new city, new school, lots to be unsure about. But at home, around family and friends, very comfortable. Until my sister overhears me laughing and says, "Geez, Annika, why is your laugh so obnoxious and loud?" So I started laughing silently for the next 7 years. That's not happily ever laughter. No, I had not yet found my voice. So in third grade, I was given a class assignment. It was a writing assignment. So we're all busily scratching away at our paper. And a classmate like leans over my desk, looks at what I'm writing. It's like, geez, Annika, why is your handwriting so horribly large? And so then that was the catalyst for me writing super, super small for quite a number of years, right or wrong. But I had not yet found my voice. But in fourth grade, things changed. I started going to a gifted program once a week. I started tutoring second graders in reading, and I joined the unicycling club with our musical performer, by the way. And I realized, I had an epiphany, that it felt good to take up space. It felt so good that I knew if I wanted to really reach my full potential and overcome my shyness, whether it was self-imposed or not, I needed a plan. So, as any 10-year-old would, I made a list, and it was a promise to always search for how to be, how to fully take up space and be unequivocally me. And sure, there were things like learn 5 languages before I graduate high school and learn car mechanics, but there were also things like enroll in a drama class. And so it wasn't until middle school that I took a drama class, and it was a workshop at the Civic Theater, and the last class was a performance. And I was cast as the narrator because no one else had the memory or enunciating prowess to get the job done, I guess. And that led to the following year when I started high school. I actually won Best Breakout Female for my work in Elsie's A Midsummer Night's Dream. That's very nice of you. But then with languages, my second language, I didn't start working on that until high school. But that prompted a third language in college and then some practical use abroad. And no, I didn't learn car mechanics, but I did get my neighbor to teach me how to change an air filter. So, you know, I mean, there are many items on the list that only were partially completed or entirely skipped, but I felt a shift long before I ever crossed anything off. And it was that commitment to choose to act rather than the act itself. So this prompted, you know, age 16, I decided to compete in a citywide poetry slam. And I won, and I got to open for Garrison Keillor at the Opera House. And, you know, at 21, you know, after having fresh wounds, both literal and figurative, from an autoimmune diagnosis and heartbreak, I decided to leave the continent for the first time, and I moved to New Zealand to farm, which was an incredible experience, barn none. And at 23, back stateside, I auditioned and got into an all-female marimba band that was known for bringing Zimbabwe's music to all of the Portland, Oregon farmers markets for over 2 decades. And, you know, this comes up to 2015. I moved back to Spokane, and it's my 27th birthday, and my sister, she comes up a lot, she gifted me a 6-week improv class, which then led me to audition and get into the Blue Door Theater's improv troupe. So I've been performing there since 2015. And, you know, it's no surprise that this list I made, that 10-year-old me made, led me to improv, because yes and is the heart of the art form. And so the promise I made was basically yes anding myself, so taking me further and looking beyond. So last year, went to the Pun-Off World Championships, the improvised division. You know, I won my first round. I ended up striking out in my second round, but I made it into the top 16. Some would argue I placed 9th. You can interpret that as you will. But then this past May, I go back and I compete in the prepared division, and I deliver a blistering and punny letter to Congress. And I end up with the second highest score on the board in a six-way tie for third place. And so all six of us come back on stage and we deliver a 20-second recap, and then it's left in the hands of hundreds and hundreds of pun connoisseurs to tell who actually gets that third place medal. So that standing ovation and the roar of that applause is something that secured my third place win in the 2017 Pun Off World Championships. But that's something I'll never forget. I mean, that promise I made to myself took me that far. And there are so many promises that are prone to be broken, like, yeah, Rumi, I promise I'll do the dishes tonight. Or, hey, Mom, yeah, I promise I'll help you with your new phone. She's in the audience, so it's funny. But this promise remarkably stayed intact and alive. And I now work in advocacy, so I'm fighting daily for people to have the right to speak and to have their voices heard. And, you know, because of this constant challenge to myself to go further, I have finally, finally been able to find my voice.
Thank you, Annika. Hey, during rehearsals at the end of her story, we said, do you still have that list? And she does. I have a couple of students in the audience, current students, I have some former students, and the thing I like about this story is I don't think people realize when you're a teacher how much the students affect you too, how much you kind of take them home, how much you think about them, how much you care about how well they do, and they can bug you more than they should, and they can inspire you more than they should. And we're going to bring up legendary Whitworth professor Leonard Oakland to tell a story about some really powerful students that he came in contact with. So please welcome Leonard Oakland.
Well, it's a story about promises. I promised Dwight that I'd stay with him, I'd back him up. Now you have to understand, there are parts of promises that get kept, and there are some parts that don't get kept. In Spokane, at Whitworth, at Gonzaga, it was the Vietnam War tearing families apart. Dwight was a sophomore at Whitworth, a history major, a basketball player, and somebody who hung around my house. He was important to me and to my wife. Dwight was morally outraged by the war. He grew increasingly angry from week to week, and finally, he turned in his draft card in fury and moral outrage. And I said, Dwight, I'll stick with you. It's a promise. Well, I have to tell you about Martin. When I first started teaching at Whitworth, I had Martin. He showed up in one of my evening classes. Here are these 15 middle-aged women teachers studying Homer, Virgil, and Dante with me, and there's Martin sitting in the corner, glowering in his leather jacket, skinny, neo-Nazi motorcycle rider, didn't want to join the Hells Angels because it was too conformist. Yeah. So we've got Dwight and we've got Martin. Part of my promise was I went off to Portland to testify in Dwight's trial when he was arraigned. The president of Whitworth College also went. That's how Dwight was respected at Whitworth. And just as I was there in Portland, I called home to my wife in Spokane, and she said, something's happened. Martin's in jail, and his wife Valerie, is now living with us. I said, oh, okay, we can cope with that. And you see, Lynn is my wonderful wife of just a couple of years. She's getting very pregnant at this time. And Valerie has moved in with us. Valerie is a very quiet woman in the biker tradition where as Martin often explained, that the only virtue in a woman was silence. Oh, hey, I told you about him already. Don't be surprised. But Martin was a good guy and a very, very intelligent guy, as he would tell you. And did. Well, Valerie was now living with us. And Dwight and Eric, oh yeah, Eric. Eric was another conscientious objector who got tried with Dwight. They came to visit us in Spokane. The judge said, okay, you can take a week before you go to jail, federal penitentiary. So they came to my house and we had a dinner for those Whitworth students who were very active in opposing the Vietnam War. So we're sitting around the table, Dwight and Eric and these other students, and having a little wine and arguing and pounding the table. And Valerie's sitting there being a good biker wife, not saying a single thing. But every week, Valerie gets to go visit her husband in the county jail where he's being held meanwhile, before he's being sent back to federal penitentiary. And she tells him everything that goes on at our house, like this party. Of all these people sitting around, pounding the table, and arguing about the war, and saying, you know, we should just go drive down to Lompoc and pound on the door and say, here we are. Well, in Valerie's world, by the way, her father and brothers were all cops, but in Valerie's world, going to prison was second only to death. And here are these guys who are saying, we're going to go drive down there, knock on the door, and get in. Well, at this moment, the doorbell rang. And in walks John the cook, the stoniest stoner student I have ever had in my days, who was, of course, loaded at the time. And he was coming to say goodbye to his favorite professor because he was going to Canada to avoid the draft. It just exploded. I mean, everybody around the table is saying, what the hell are you talking about going to Canada? You should be doing your moral duty and oppose the war. And John, who was fairly befuddled in the best of times, was saying, well, you know, it doesn't really matter that much. When you die, you don't really die. You achieve higher consciousness. And everybody, and they started saying, well, why don't you go to Vietnam and achieve higher consciousness? John didn't have any coherent reason for that or much of any other thing, and so he left. So Valerie reports to Martin. And then the next week, Dwight and Eric get sent to federal penitentiary, chained to Martin. They know nothing about him. He knows everything about them. And here come these two liberal pacifists chained to this biker, and they end up, all three of them, in Lompoc Federal Penitentiary. Well, part of my promise, some months later, my wife and I and our little baby did go down to Lompoc. And we did visit Dwight, and we did visit Martin. That was promise kept. But then there's the letters. Because the one thing Dwight asked me was to write him letters when he was in prison. He wrote to me every couple of weeks, but I could never write back. I didn't know what to say to somebody whose life was being that radically affected, who is in the joint dealing with this hour by hour, day by day. It was a promise I didn't keep, or partly kept. And you know, last December, my former wife, Lynn, had died. And I was at the memorial service, and there was Dwight. I hadn't seen him in 40 years. And he came up to me just bursting with open-heartedness. And I thought about the letters. Sometimes a promise kept is not as strong as a promise not kept.
Thank you, Leonard.
our last story before the break is about dating, partly. Full disclosure, when I heard this story, I didn't understand it because I haven't dated since 1986. I met the woman who would become my wife when I was 15 years old, and we've been dating ever since. So, well, we're married now. You get the idea. So she's telling the story, and she's talking about swiping left or right. And I just have to be honest, I have no idea what that means. So if you know what this means, you will understand a lot better than I did. Will you please welcome Megan Ferney?
I swipe left through a stack of Tinder profiles on my phone. I'm always right on the edge of deleting the online dating app, and I rarely check it. And when I do, it seems like the profiles are all the same. Not here for a hookup, the guys always say. But I mean, if you have to say it, what does that say about you? And what's with the naked bathroom pictures from here to here with the cell phone and the flash? And then my second favorite is the guys all posing to large dead animals. It's hot. Or the photos where every single photo involves a dead fish. That's also hot. And then there's the guy that takes the time to actually put like 5 photos in his profile, but they're all taken in the same clothing and assumedly on the same day. So here's a picture of me under a baseball hat in my car. And here's a picture of me in my baseball hat in my living room. And here's a picture of me in my baseball hat in the backyard. And here's me in the front yard. It's like, wow, you go all of those places? You are so interesting. And I guess the other thing is, you know, if you're going to put a profile out there where anyone can see it, everyone can read it, I mean, go ahead or remember the correct uses of there, and there. I mean, if you're going to write 2 sentences about yourself, let's go ahead and do it with correct grammar. And I think the other thing is that, I mean, really, I'm not all that interested in dating in the first place. I just want to meet people to go do stuff with and have fun with. The next profile I come across is a photo of a bald man in the top of a tree looking up in the camera, and I'm intrigued. So I click on his profile, and he's quite a bit younger than I am by at least 8 years, but his photos are all action shots. He's on skateboards, he's on snowboards, he's on mountains, he's hanging on to the end of a rope, and it looks like he's about to slam into the side of a house. So I make the very unusual swipe right, and soon we have plans to meet downtown at a wine bar. I don't even like wine. I agreed to meet him at a wine bar because 1, it was a place that I've never been to before, and 2, he came up with a plan. He picked a time and a place. He said he didn't care. He didn't ask me to pick it. He just said, how about the Left Bank Wine Bar on this time and this day? I mean, I would have met this guy at a bar under the railroad tracks. The Left Bank Wine Bar is a warm and cozy place, and David is easy to pick out of the crowd. He has a big smile on his face. He's easy to talk to. And I admit to him that I don't like wine, knowing that I'm losing points on the sophisticated scale, and order a glass of cider instead. And usually about halfway through a drink with a stranger, I'm already thinking of excuses of how to get out of this situation. And I don't really feel a romantic connection with this guy, but I do feel a strong friend connection. And I'm not feeling that urge to get out of here as soon as possible. So when we finished our drinks, it was as easy as anything to walk out into the warm summer night, Riverfront Park. We're walking through the park, and he says, have you ever climbed the sculpture? And I was like, what sculpture? And in my mind, I'm thinking, I mean, I know there's some pilgrims on the Centennial Trail, and there's like a miner guy by the Opera House, and I'm trying to figure out why you would climb these and even how you would do it. And through some more back and forth dialogue, we figure out that I've never noticed the sculpture that he's talking about. And he says, well, do you still want to climb it? And I was like, well, yeah. I mean, I'm so excited to be with this adventurous soul, and I'm also really happy that it wasn't just another night in a bar with an uninspired guy who's just trying to say what he thinks I want to hear. It's big. This sculpture is like 2 or 3 stories tall. It's made out of thick white concrete. It's kind of got filigree-shaped holes all the way through it. It's got 4 sides, kind of like a milk carton, empty milk carton. And I was like, this is on private property. Like, isn't this illegal? Like, what if the cops come? And he's like, well, that's why we do it in the dark. So we also climb it from the inside, so it's really hard for people to see you unless they really look. And we don't use any kind of lights. You just have to let your eyes adjust to the darkness. Do you still want to do it? So I hide my purse under a bush at the base of the sculpture. And we squeeze to the inside. And I'm looking at it from a rock climber's perspective because there's really big, solid holds. But there's also big consequences because you're not tied into a harness or a rope. So he says he likes to climb in the corners because then you have angles, like you can push from different angles. And he starts up. And so I go to the adjacent corner and I find 2 good handholds and I find 2 good footholds and I'm off the ground. And from then on, it's just keep climbing up. I'm almost to the top and I have a great view of Riverfront Park and the Spokane River. And David's at the top, he's sitting at the top looking down and he's like, congratulations, you did it. So I'm trying to finagle my way into sort of a sitting position without falling off. I was like, well, yeah, I mean, otherwise, you know, I would have fallen down. And we sit up there and we kind of talk in hushed conspiratorial tones into the wee hours of the morning. And I don't know it at the time, but he will become one of my great adventure partners. He will teach me to longboard by taking me to a section of the Centennial Trail. And although he may argue this, lets me go down an extremely steep hill with a sharp left-hand corner and a bridge at the bottom. And as I'm walking back up the hill, he's running down and his eyes are huge and he says, why did you go down that hill? He goes, you bet you were going 25 miles an hour. And I looked at him and I'm shaking and the adrenaline won't leave my body for days. And I was like, that was not 25 miles an hour, that was 1,000. On our way out, he tells me about all the people they've taken out of there with broken elbows and broken knees. And about 2 years later, I enter my very first longboard competition. It's in the kids' division. I get last place. And when you get last place, you have to put a Zoomies sticker, which is the poser skateboard shop, on your board in shame. Secretly, I'm a little proud of it. I teach him to rock climb. I take him for the first time, and he uses all my gear, and he loves it. He's a natural. Within a month, he has all his own gear. Within a year, he's climbing harder routes than I've ever done. He's also teaching all of his friends and family how to do it. And a couple years later, he teaches his girlfriend how to rock climb, and it becomes the main thing that they do as a couple. They have recently been married, and it's still the main thing that they do as a couple. So I'm sitting on a sculpture in the middle of the night, on a warm summer night in the park, with a stranger who doesn't feel like a stranger. And I'm just trying to figure out, like, why people click? Like, what are the character traits that make me want to be around someone? And why is this relationship so easy? And David interrupts my thoughts and he says, have you noticed the plaque? And I was like, what plaque? And there's a plaque, it's about this big, it's bronze. It's embedded in the top of the sculpture, in the concrete. And I lean over to read the inscription, and it says, transcend the bullshit. Ah, I said, perfect. That's really what it's all about, in friendships and relationships and life.
That was Megan Ferney from Pivot Spokane. Earlier we heard Leonard Oakland and began with Annika Eagle. Tomorrow, Nicole Mischke and Skylar Oberst. After these are broadcast, Pivot Stories may be heard as podcasts at kpbx.org.